From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the secret to preparing a juicy Thanksgiving turkey, we hear from chef and culinary scientist Shirley Corrier. In her book, Cookwise, she explains how ingredients interact in recipes and how you can avoid a culinary disaster. Also, we remember film director Alan Pakula, who died yesterday in a freak car accident. His films include The Sterile Cuckoo, All the President's Men, Clute, Sophie's Choice, and The Pelican Brief. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the TV remake of the Hitchcock classic Rear Window, starring Christopher Reeve and Daryl Hannah. And film critic John Powers reviews Elizabeth, starring Cate Blanchett as the Queen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. This hour is the deadline for states to decide whether to join the $206 billion settlement with the tobacco industry. Georgia is one of the states to sign on today. Joshua Leves of member station WABE in Atlanta explains why.
State officials say that by joining in the $206 billion multi-state settlement, Georgia gets more money than it would have through litigating or settling on its own. The state's original suit against the tobacco industry sought $2.8 billion. Under the terms of the joint settlement, Georgia gets $4.8 billion. The funds are technically meant to reimburse Georgia for its Medicaid costs in treating sick smokers. Like many other states, Georgia had claimed that the tobacco industry improperly encourages people to smoke without making them adequately aware of the health dangers. The settlement includes a provision to protect tobacco farmers. Georgia's attorney general and officials from other tobacco-growing states are demanding that the tobacco industry fund the settlement in a way that will not burden growers. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Former Senate Watergate counsel Sam Dash has resigned as ethics advisor to independent counsel Ken Starr. Dash says that's because Starr testified before the House Judiciary Committee, and Dash says that violated Starr's obligations to remain independent of the impeachment proceedings. Starr says the two men had a gentle disagreement.
I respect him. I admire him. I think he's a total man of principle. I have really profited from his judgment. And I think as a matter of principle, this was so important to him that he felt that the right thing to do was to take the action that he has taken. And I admire that.
Dash is a Democrat. He's advised Starr on a range of issues during the past 4 years. A Russian Proton rocket has blasted off from Kazakhstan, carrying the first part of the International Space Station. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Despite the gray sky and windy conditions, the Proton rocket thundered into space over the vast, desolate steppe of Kazakhstan, safely putting the Zarya module into orbit. The Russian-built, U.S.-funded module will provide the initial power and propulsion to the International Space Station, which will be assembled in orbit over the next 6 years. Today's launch was a modest start to the complex and expensive project, but an important step, according to U.S. astronaut Michael Foal.
We are doing the first steps, baby steps, to build the International Space Station, and after that we will be able to form the first rocket that can go to the moon and then onto Mars.
He glossed over some of the difficulties that have dogged the space station up to now. The program is a year and a half behind schedule, partly because Russia has had trouble funding the service module. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, at the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan.
The Dow is up 85 points at this hour. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, pilots at FedEx have agreed to resume contract talks with the company. That effectively ends any threat of a strike during the busy holiday shipping season. A union spokesman says talks will resume on Monday. The last talks were held on October 30th. Stocks appear to be ready to end the week on an optimistic note. The market is mostly higher at midday as both financial and technology stocks gain ground. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
On the last trading day of a week in which the Federal Reserve Board cut interest rates by another quarter of a point, and most of the economic indicators have been positive, Wall Street's doing a little celebrating. Stocks have been up above 9,100 for most of the morning, with the stock market now just several hundred points away from its all-time high set back in July. Investors seem to be a lot more upbeat than they were just a few months ago. Bank stocks are higher today. That's on optimism their shares will gain the most from lower interest rates and the rebound in global financial markets. Technology stocks are also up, mostly on expectations that growth in that sector will also be strong. Shares in online bookseller Amazon.com rose as much as 16% today. That was after the company announced a 3-for-1 stock split. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Dell Computer Corporation begins taking orders today for the industry's first built-to-order PCs with factory-installed Cisco ADSL modems. The new PCs will allow customers to access the net from 4 to 125 times faster than with traditional modems. Continental Airlines has announced plans to buy 10 wide-body jets from Boeing. The order is reportedly worth $880 million. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're probably already thinking about your Thanksgiving dinner. On this archive edition, we have an interview with a culinary expert who can not only give you recipes for a great Thanksgiving dinner, she can explain the science and chemistry behind the techniques. Shirley Carrier is the cook, mini restaurant, and test kitchen chef's call to explain why a recipe is failing and how to fix it. She's a former biochemist turned cookbook author and cooking teacher. I spoke with her last year after the publication of her book, Cookwise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. I asked her to explain some of the principles that would help us make a better turkey.
Well, my absolutely favorite thing to do with turkeys and with large roasting hens, and I've even done it with shrimp, is to soak them in brine. Now, this is what I do with the large hen, I would use like a full cup of salt. Now, with the turkey, the smaller turkeys, I'd go with a cup and a half of salt and put them in a large container that I could cover it with ice water and keep it in the refrigerator overnight. Then before you roast the turkey, you want to rinse it very well, get all the surface salt off. And it is astonishing how much juicier turkeys are prepared in this way. And they've weighed birds, you know, before and after brining, and they gain weight significantly. And you can certainly see it in the incredible juiciness.
Now, what principles determine how long to cook a turkey and what temperature to roast it at?
Well, now, I think anybody you ask is going to have a different answer on this. And I'd certainly advise people, if they have a system that has worked, stick with it. Some things to remember. The leg and thigh meat has to be cooked to a higher temperature than the breast, and this is a real problem. Those legs and thighs actually taste metallic and slimy if they're not cooked over 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the breast, on the other hand, which is the broad expanse that gets the most heat usually, that starts drying out anywhere from 155 up. It's getting drier and losing more moisture. So what I try to do is arrange it in the pan so that I can actually move the whole pan and the bird over to one wall so that it's near the hot wall of the oven to get that leg and thigh cooked well. And then I divide the time, and then I push it over to the other wall so the other leg and thigh get some extra heat on the cooking time. I think everybody's oven varies dramatically, and it's just impossible to give correct times, I believe, and temperatures. We can talk a little bit about temperatures. I like to start at a very high temperature and then turn the oven down for slower cooking. I want to get the outside hot. Get things really going, and then turn it down so that it cooks more slowly to stay juicy and tender inside. So I would say I would actually start a bird maybe 450, 475, And if the bird's not too big, I start it breast down then do these to both sides and then flip it over.
You are an advocate of a good thermometer. How do you use the thermometer when you're roasting a turkey?
Well, you want to try to be careful not to touch bone. So I like to insert I insert it once in the thigh and try to get into the fleshy area and go down so that, you know, at least an inch or so of the thermometer shaft is into the bird. And now this is with one of the little instant reads. Some people, and now on the breast, I insert it there also. So I like to check both places, check the temperature of the leg and thigh, and check the temperature on the breast. Now, the big fat-based thermometers go into the bird, and I would say they would have to go into the breast portion of the bird and can remain in during the whole cooking time. The important thing to remember is that that temperature is going to increase after you take the bird out of the oven. So be sure to get the bird out before it reaches your maximum temperature.
Why is the temperature going to increase after you take it out of the hot oven?
Oh, because, the outside of that bird was super hot, and that heat is still being conducted from layer to layer to layer inward. And a big turkey could increase easily 10 degrees after it comes out of the oven. So you want to be sure to get it out 10 degrees before you really want it.
What temperature do you look for?
Now, we're the FDA absolutely insists on 180 degrees. So this would mean get it out at 170. I think the breast is way too dry at that, and I'm willing to take my risk personally to go, a little lower on that. I hate to cook a turkey breast over 160.
And you've never been sued by your guests?
They've all survived.
They've all survived.
Goodness, Terry.
Okay. Now, for people who want to make, say, an interesting potato dish.
Yes.
For Thanksgiving, what would you recommend?
Well, my grandmother's old-fashioned grated sweet potato pudding is sensational. It's totally different from any of the modern sweet potato dishes. You grate the sweet potatoes raw, and actually what you do, you can do it in a processor just with the chopping knife and chop it with quick on-offs until the pieces are small like rice. And you stir these raw chopped sweet potatoes with a cup of brown sugar and a cup of half and half or cream. My grandmother used, her whole milk on the farm. And 2 teaspoons of dry ginger, and I think a little salt, and if my memory, a tablespoon of cornmeal, and 1 egg. And stir this together and bake. It's a deep brown and a very unusual texture, but it's a truly old, old dish. I know some of my students make it every year for Christmas and Thanksgiving, and one took it a big plate over to a nearby nursing home. And she said one of the little ladies who was in her 90s, when she started eating it, that tears rolled down her cheeks. She said, I haven't had this dish since I was a little girl. So it is a truly old but traditional holiday preparation.
My guest is Shirley Carrier. She's an expert on the science and techniques of cooking. Let's get to baking. A lot of baking happening for the holidays. You write in your new book that you made terrible cakes until you understood the principles behind how cakes rise with baking powder and soda. What were you doing wrong, and what's the right way to do it?
Well, I didn't realize this, but baking powder and baking soda, they don't make a single new bubble. All they do is enlarge bubbles that are already in the batter. And this makes that creaming step, where you cream the butter and the sugar together, this makes that step vitally important, because you're beating all the air bubbles in your cake in right there. And see, I had never paid any attention to that step. I just barely mixed the butter and the sugar and threw the eggs and the rest of the ingredients on and zip, 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 and my cakes were flat as a flitter. I did notice when I worked in a restaurant that the pastry chef there would put the butter and sugar on and leave it on the mixer for what seemed like ages while she ran around doing other things. And then she would finally come back and add the eggs and the other ingredients. And her cakes were a mile high. But it's these bubbles in the fat that are really crucial for good volume.
Well, I'm going to stop you first. So in other words, the baking powder or the baking soda expands the bubbles that are already there.
That's correct.
So
that's correct.
The baking powder or baking soda is only going to do its job if it has bubbles to work with.
That's right. And that's why those bubbles in the fat are so important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Another big problem is the amount of baking powder or baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
1 teaspoon of baking powder almost perfectly leavens a cup of flour, or 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda leavens a cup of flour. And there are many recipes out there that simply have too much leavener in them. And what happens? The bubbles get big, big, big and huge, and then pop, and there goes your leavening. So your muffins or your cakes fall. And this is just the opposite of what you would think. You know, if something has fallen, you think, oh, maybe I needed more baking powder. But this is not the case, so you might check your recipes. You know, there you can allow some error. You can go up to 1 1/4 teaspoon of baking powder. But there are some recipes out there that a 1.5 cup little muffin recipe has 1 teaspoon of baking powder, that's fine, but then 1 teaspoon of soda, and that's enough for 4 cups of flour. So you've got enough for 5 cups of flour there, and those muffins are going to fall and be practically unleavened.
An interesting cooking paradox. To help us understand how dough behaves and how breads and cakes behave, tell us something about gluten and how it works.
Yes. Whenever you add water to flour and stir, there are two little proteins, gluten and gliadin, and they grab water and each other and form these springy, bubblegum-like elastic sheets of gluten. And sometimes you want this gluten, and sometimes you don't. Whenever you're doing something that you need strength, like a strudel, you want this strong elastic sheets. Whenever you're doing yeast products, yeast oozes out a little liquid, and the minute it hits a bubble in the dough, it releases carbon dioxide gas, which blows up. So these bubble gum sheets of gluten are perfect to be inflated. You know, it blows. On the other hand, if you want something tender, you know, you want a tender pie crust or tender muffins or tender cakes, you don't want this gluten. And there are several ways that you can prevent it. You know, the traditional way of making a pie crust, you take fat and put it directly on the flour. This is no water present. And what you're doing, you grease these little proteins so that when you do add the water, they're so greasy they can't grab water in each other and hook together.
What about sugar? That plays a part too, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Now, sugar has a major role. Sugar actually will combine with each one of these little proteins, and you get a sugar protein compound and another sugar protein compound, and you don't get any gluten formed. So with yeast doughs, you may have noticed that there are not any really, really, really sweet doughs. Most of them have sweet, gooey fillings. But the dough itself is limited. You can only put 1 tablespoon of sugar per cup of flour in a yeast dough, or you start losing volume dramatically. On the other hand, sugar in pie crust, muffins, and cakes serves as a tenderizer. It helps prevent the strong elastic sheets of gluten from forming.
My guest is Shirley Carrier, author of the book Cookwise. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Shirley Carrier. She's an expert in the science of cooking. Do you have a favorite apple pie recipe that would be simple enough to describe on the radio?
I'm afraid my apple pie recipe is complicated, but let me just give a simplified. And see, with a double crusted pie, what happens? The apples are full of water, so they are leaking water like crazy. So that's going to make the bottom crust soggy. And then with all this liquid in the hot oven, you've got lots of steam. That makes the top crust soggy. And the apples shrink dramatically. So you've got this huge hole between the apples and the crust. So what I do to solve the problem is just bake the bottom crust empty. And I think that Thanksgiving, you should consider that maybe you need a little help. If time is short, use a store-bought crust. But bake that bottom crust crisp and dry. And then you can put a dough circle on a slight domed top. And I do turn a large stainless steel bowl upside down and spray it with nonstick spray and put a dough circle on. And you can cut it with simple slits, or you can decorate it with vines and leaves, you know, whatever you're up to, and bake that so the top is totally crisp and dry. And then I make the filling in a big pot on the stove. And I make a lot of filling. You know, I'll use 10 big apples and maybe 14 little apples. We're talking about a lot of filling. Then I can pile this filling up really, really high in the crisp crust and put the dome on top. Add it later. There are all sorts of variations, and you can do it actually with bought crust so that you don't have to totally kill yourself.
This sounds very good. I just have one question for you. Mm-hmm. When you're doing the dome top,
yes,
and you're baking that separately, how do you get the size right? Because isn't the size going to change a little bit as it bakes or not?
Well, I go with a 12-inch dough circle. And it doesn't seem to matter. As I go with at least a 10-inch bowl. And anywhere from a 9 to 10-inch stainless steel bowl measuring across the top, that will give you a really nice domed top. And the great thing, it cuts like a dream because, see, you don't have that big gap between the apples and the top because you pile those apples high, really high, so they fill up the dome. And so you're sitting that dome down, squishing it right against the apples.
And then the top and the bottom crust bake together? Are they?
No, you don't bake it again. You simply assemble it.
How did you get into the more scientific, analytical end of cooking?
Well, I started out as a research biochemist for the Vanderbilt Medical School in Nashville, Tennessee. And I worked in biochemistry also at the U.S. Vitamin Company. But my former husband and I started a boys' private school. So I had 140 teenage boys that I fed 3 meals a day for 11 years. So I got an awful lot of heavy-duty cooking experience. And friends, and I used to go to cooking classes whenever I could. And if something was wrong during the class, after class, I'd explain to the teacher what had happened because frequently from my science background, I knew exactly what to do to prevent that disaster. So soon people all over the Southeast were calling me with their cooking problems. And I didn't always know the answer, but as a good researcher, I knew how to get the answer. So I would go to the literature, locate someone who was an expert in the field and call them. And I think these experts are always willing to share their knowledge if you're polite and don't take up much of their time, have a very specific question. So through the years, I have received calls from, hundreds and hundreds of people in the food business. I answer calls for test kitchens, for home cooks, for magazine editors, book editors, food writers. And I always learn, many times I can answer their question instantly, but many times there's a, you know, someone that's maybe fascinating, but I always learn so much myself from investigating the questions that I don't know. Another great family tip I'd love to pass on.
Please, yeah.
My mother made the best gravy imaginable.
Yes, I should ask you about gravy. Go ahead.
Well, I thought I watched her and I thought I knew exactly how she did it. But what I missed all these years was that she would take out one or two cups of the raw dressing mix, you know, before when she mixed it up and put it in the pan. She would save one or two cups and add that to the gravy to thicken it. And it was marvelous. You don't realize it's there, but the gravy has then all the wonderful flavors and the, you know, sage and herbs and onions and celery that you had in the dressing, you know, are in there. And it's just a wonderful touch.
So when you say that your mother added dressing to the gravy, this she would add some of the stuffing to the gravy?
Yes, the raw stuffing before
it's baked.
The raw stuffing.
Okay.
The raw stuffing, which, you know, is composed of the breadcrumbs and herbs and onion and celery. So she would put that raw stuffing into the drippings and the gravy, and it would thicken so much nicer than just cornstarch or flour alone.
Well, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you, and I certainly wish everyone good luck with their turkey and cakes and pies.
Shirley Carrier recruited last year after the publication of her book, Cookwise. She's now working on her book, Bakewise, on the science of baking. It's scheduled to be published in the spring of 2002. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate, too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irvy. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, mandrake. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and Perseus Books, publisher of Enterprise.com, the new book on market leadership in the information age by Lotus CEO Jeff Pappas. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with director Alan Pakula. He died yesterday in a freak car accident. His films include Clute, All the President's Men, and The Pelican Brief. Also, reviews of the new film Elizabeth and the TV remake of Rear Window starring Christopher Reeve. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elizabeth is the new period drama about Queen Elizabeth, starring Australian actress Kate Blanchett, who's being touted as an Oscar contender for her performance. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
While TV programs about history are usually illustrated lessons, movies about history tend to be grandiose potboilers. That's precisely the case with Elizabeth, an extremely entertaining feminist soap opera filled with so much sex, murder, and treachery that Geraldo must regret he wasn't born in the 16th century. It begins in 1554, when England's in trouble. Abroad, it's being threatened by France and Spain. At home, Queen Mary is trying to restore Catholicism as the country's faith. But there's one big problem. Since the ailing Mary will die childless, her successor will be her half-sister Elizabeth, played by Kate Blanchett, and Elizabeth happens to be a Protestant. Although Catholic loyalists try to block her ascent to the throne, Elizabeth does become the queen of the weak, divided, insolvent country. And to her court's dismay, she doesn't do what she's told, namely marry a suitor from either France or Spain. Intent on being her own woman, she initially flaunts her relationship with her unreliable lover, Robert Dudley, played rather boringly by Joseph Fiennes. But the canny Elizabeth soon realizes that she'll be dead if she doesn't make herself into a proper queen. She begins taking the advice of her official protector, Sir Francis Walsingham, a Machiavellian spymaster superbly played by Geoffrey Rush from Shine. Here, after a disastrous battle in Scotland, Walsingham gives Elizabeth a small lesson in realpolitik.
Why did they send such children? Why did they not send proper reinforcements?
Because the bishops would not let them. They spoke against it in the pulpits.
Then they are speaking against their queen.
Madam, the bishops are against you and have no fear of you. They do not expect you to survive.
Elizabeth was written by Michael Hirst, who won't exactly have professional historians celebrating his devotion to the facts. By merging various characters and events, he transforms a true story into something more exciting, an Elizabethan version of The Godfather. Like Michael Corleone, Elizabeth goes from being an innocent bystander to one who learns how to pull the strings of power. The movie even has the visual darkness of The Godfather. It begins with a stylized torture scene done in inky blacks, and aside from a few sun-stunned outdoor sequences, most of the action takes place in dank castles where shadows threaten to devour the characters in their exquisitely layered gowns. I mention the clothing because the whole movie is filled with a kind of arresting photography, odd camera angles and so forth, that's more appropriate to a fashion spread than a film. Yet while the movie's look is self-conscious, the storytelling is not. Elizabeth is vigorously directed by Shekhar Kapoor, whose last film was The Bandit Queen, the real-life story of Poolan Devi, a low-caste Indian woman who triumphed over forced marriage and gang rape to become a political leader. While this new movie marks a clear advance for Kapoor, it tells a similar story of a woman learning to claim her own power. There's been no better woman's role this year than Elizabeth, and the fine Australian actress Kate Blanchett wears it like a diamond tiara. Blanchett has a difficult beauty. It can go from ethereal to spiky in the flicker of an eyelash, and she uses it to give us several very different Elizabeths. The sweet-natured innocent who's in too deep, the carnal creature who dances a sexy volta with her lover, the increasingly confident sovereign who publicly toys with Catholic bishops, and the imperious queen who insists on her own absolute authority. "I am no man's Elizabeth," she says fiercely. Although the movie's not deep, it is well aware that you don't get power for free. Just as becoming godfather turned Michael Corleone into a moral monster, so Elizabeth eventually becomes an eerie ghost of a monarch, her hair cropped, her face so smeared with white makeup that she resembles a glazed donut. She has seized the authority she will wield for the next 40 years, yet her public triumph is also something of a personal tragedy. All the lightness has gone from her spirit. Unable to survive as both queen and full-blooded woman, she makes herself into a denatured icon, the Virgin Queen. She may be the first recorded case in history of that media cliché, the career woman who discovers you can't have it all.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Film director Alan J. Pakula died yesterday in a freak car accident. He was driving home on the Long Island Expressway when a 7-foot metal pipe crashed through the windshield of his car, striking him in the head. His car then hit a fence. Pakula was 70 years old. He started his film career in the early 60s, producing To Kill a Mockingbird and Love with a Proper Stranger. He went on to direct The Sterile Cuckoo, Clute, The Parallax View, All the President's Men, Starting Over, Sophie's Choice, Presumed Innocent, and The Pelican Brief. He was working on an adaptation of No Ordinary Time, Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. In 1990, Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson spoke with Pakula. Sedge is the host of West Coast Live, which is carried on many public radio stations. Let's start with a scene from Pakula's legal thriller, Presumed Innocent. Harrison Ford stars as a prosecuting attorney investigating the brutal murder of a colleague with whom he'd had a secret affair. Halfway through the investigation, the DA's office is given evidence that implicates Harrison Ford. Brian Dennehy plays the district attorney.
Molto and DeLay, I've raised some questions about the Paul Hemis investigation.
This should not be handled this way. You should speak with Rusty alone.
What's this about?
It's about the fact that you were in Carolyn's apartment the night she was killed.
Bullshit. What was that, a Tuesday night? Barbara was at the university. I was babysitting.
Rusty. For your own sake, keep your mouth shut.
We've got the fingerprint results. The ones you could never remember to ask for. And they're your prints all over the bar glass. Yours, Rosette K. Savage. 5 feet from where the woman was found dead. Or maybe you didn't remember that all county employees get printed.
My God, you're serious.
Ellen Pakula co-wrote and directed the screen adaptation of Scott Turow's novel, Presumed Innocent. He spent a year on the script after reading the first draft of the screenplay.
If you're doing a suspense film, it is very important the audience have certain facts so they always know where they're at, so they know what to hope for or what to be afraid of. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where the suspense comes from. If the audience has no set of facts that they can relate to, then there's no suspense, and you have to have this feeling of, oh, this could happen or this can happen. Which one will happen? That's suspense. If you don't have enough set of facts to say, to have that, to ask those questions, then you just sort of go along staring at the story, but there is not that kind of excitement. And with a story this complicated, with this many characters, this kind of character study, whodunit, you're always juggling these characters, making sure that the audience doesn't have too many names that they have to follow, too many clues they have to follow at once. Harrison Ford and I kept asking questions of each other every second. We would test each other by saying, all right, what do you know now about the story? Tell me, as the audience, where are you? What information do you have and what don't you have? We would keep checking.
There's a need in the course of one of these stories to place clues, facts or clues, as you go along. And how did you decide to wait certain clues versus others? Did you want the audience to try to figure out the story?
I wanted the audience to feel they were always on the verge of figuring out the story, that they were about to do it and then be teased along that much farther and given another clue that might throw them off the track. There have been several films this summer that have been physical roller coaster rides. This one is really a mental roller coaster ride in a sense, in that you are taken in one direction and then suddenly another clue takes you in another direction. And that's the fascination of this kind of thing. At the same time, unlike the ordinary melodrama story, or in the average melodrama story, Scott Turow wrote very complicated, rich characters. And you then have to stop to really develop those characters at the same time. Hitchcock once said, one of the most difficult things to do is to do character studies and suspense at the same time because the rhythms are different. So you're always balancing those rhythms. How long can you stop for character? You really can never let that story go. The great gift that Scott gave us was this extraordinary plot. At the same time, that plot became our master. We always had to serve it. In an ordinary film, you can, you know, be more leisurely and start exploring character for its own sake. Here, character always had to be revealed within the context of the plot being revealed.
Your lead, Harrison Ford, who played Rusty Savage, is a guy I associate with a fedora, a whip, or a ray gun. And here he played a very closed-in, repressed character. What did you have to do with him to get him to play this much more sort of quiet, passive, reactive rather than active role?
Actually, he's not a passive character. Indeed, events seem to take him over in many ways, but I wouldn't say that he's passive. He's a passionate prosecuting attorney when the story opens. He's a man of deep emotions. As a matter of fact, what I find interesting about the character is that it is a very active man who finds himself in a very passive position. The prosecutor is very active, and suddenly he finds himself on trial for murder, where you really are in a passive position. At the same time, he does, even during that period, have efforts in trying to deal with the case. It's a very difficult thing to ask an actor to do, especially a man who's played Indiana Jones. And the time when you work on that is even before he's decided to do it. I went out to Harrison's ranch in Wyoming when we had a script, and we spent several days together. We read through the script because while Harrison was interested, he was concerned about playing this role for the very reasons you pointed out. And I read all the other characters, and he read Rusty Savage's character. I read all the other characters badly, I might add, and I was surprised that he could even sound at all real, considering he was playing these scenes over a kitchen table with me. But during that time, we would stop and start, and you would find and discuss all of the active things going on in this character, even though he may not be revealing them obviously in dialogue. And during that time, we really found the arc of the character, the growth of the character, all of the things that might not be revealed in an immediate reading of the script, where so many of the other characters have so much more bravura dialogue, for example, than his character has. It was once, I think, Harrison saw how rich the character was in an interior way that he could, one, commit himself to do the film, and then allow himself to give such a controlled performance. The difficulty in playing that kind of character is you can't cheat. If you're playing a man who's has deep feeling but has a difficult time revealing it, he better darn well be feeling that deep feeling so that that audience has some sense that something is going on underneath. Otherwise, it'll be totally empty.
We're listening back to an interview with director Alan Pakula, who died yesterday at the age of 70. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with director Alan Pakula in conversation with Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson. Pakula died yesterday.
You've produced and directed many great films over the years, many of them from books, including To Kill a Mockingbird, Up the Down Staircase, Sophie's Choice, All the President's Men, Presumed Innocent. What is it about books that attracts you as a director, to screenplays?
Well, it's, by the way, I also do things like Clute that are from original screenplays.
Right, well.
I just want you to think that I'm a purist about only doing books. However, there is a great attraction in books, and that is all the extraordinary texture, the world you have to draw upon in a really good novel. There is so much background texture, subtext you might call it, would be subtext in a film anyway, that gives that sense of reality and richness that you have to draw upon that is sometimes more difficult to get in an original screenplay. I sometimes think that too often the average screenwriter will spend too short a time doing a screenplay, maybe weeks or months. It's not always the case, but in many cases. And a good novelist is very often spent years in developing that world and developing those characters. And that time very often has paid off in giving you just a much richer world to work with. I'm not saying, by the way, that you can't, that a genius or somebody like Preston Sturges can't do a great, write a great movie in a week or two, because there are cases of that. But by and large, having that kind of background world that the novel gives you, that to inform a film, can be very helpful indeed. Now, that has other problems. I mean, you're taking something that was designed to function in one way and asking it to function in another way. And there are many novels, I would say, that by their very nature are almost impossible to do as films.
How did you first learn to read a screenplay?
How did I learn to read a screenplay? Nobody's asked me that. I learned to read a screenplay when I had my first job at MGM. I was in love with the theater. I was a theater director when I got out of Yale. And I was 20 and at that age thought I knew a good deal more than I did, as it turned out. And it never occurred to me I had to learn how to read a screenplay. I got my first job at MGM and I was reading screenplays and making a lot of, I think, unfair, arrogant judgments. And I think in making those judgments, found out a good deal about what worked and what didn't work. I remember being at Paramount, and I was about 21, 22, and reading a screenplay of Rear Window and thinking, well, it's all very pleasant, but I don't really get the suspense in this. You know, I'm strange that Hitchcock is doing this film when it doesn't seem to have very much suspense. Well,
that must have startled you when you saw the film.
Well, when I began seeing dailies, I began learning a great deal of humility, because the difference between what is on the written page and what a director may have in mind, can be extraordinary. And while it was a perfectly craftsmanlike screenplay, the vision that Hitchcock had that informed that film was extraordinary. And I sometimes think that even today, that people who make the decisions about what films should be made and should not be made don't know how to read a screenplay. Very often will skim over because they read so many scripts, they'll take home 10 or 15 scripts to read over a weekend because they have all these decisions to make. And I think when you read that way, there's a tendency to kind of read through the dialogue, you know, and that can be a very bad way to read a screenplay, because that's not how the film's going to look. I also think that people, this is my advice to executives today, I think, should really not judge a screenplay until, if there was a director involved, make a final judgment, until they've discussed the screenplay with the director and seen see exactly what he has in mind and how much that vision is reflected by the screenplay. But those two things should go together in making the final decision.
There's a scene in Clute, which was from an original screenplay, where Jane Fonda sings a hymn, and I understand this was actually not part of the screenplay. I wonder how her, a call girl in the movie, began to sing this hymn and how it became included in the movie.
Well, that's a wonderful thing about working with actors. I always say to actors, however much you rehearse, and I believe in rehearsing, nothing pleases me more than surprises. What happens in the moment, what comes out of your own behavior. In Clute, again, we had the problem of a melodrama that was really a character study, and the two rhythms. I mean, how much time could you take to explore character? So we didn't, while she was this complicated call girl, we didn't reveal a great deal about her background, and we looked for ways to do that. And here she is, it was a scene at the very early part of the picture, and she's just picked up a trick, and just had the trick, and now she's home in her apartment alone, and she's smoking pot at that point, and sitting there and relaxing. And at that moment, I was also trying to dramatize it. In some ways, that trick for her was a fix, not a sexual fix. Somewhere or other, it was a release of some kind of compulsive tensions. And for that moment, there was a moment of peace, and she's sitting in her apartment alone smoking that pot. And I didn't say to Jane, do a hymn. I just said, you know that character well enough. We've rehearsed this thing long enough. Let's see what you feel like. And she sat there, and she started to hum in this pot-like trance that this character's in. da 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 da. And there was this hymn that most of us have all learned at Thanksgiving as children in school. And suddenly you could see this character in some small town somewhere, having been an ordinary little child or with some kind of upbringing we could all relate to. That just came out of Jane, just as Jane insisted on having health food in the refrigerator in that apartment. And it, again, created a fascinating tension of a girl who has this most self-destructive kind of behavior, being a prostitute, and then goes home and stocks her refrigerator full of health food and makes herself all sorts of health food mixes. That's the kind of work I ask from actors. We sometimes try to create together, and I also encourage them to do it for themselves.
Alan Pakula speaking with Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson in 1990. Pakula died yesterday in a freak car accident. Here's the scene from Clute with Jane Fonda that Pakula just described.
We gather together to ask the Lord's blessing. He hastens and chastens his wisdom divine. And from the beginning, the fight we were winning. Lord, be at our side, divine.
Coming up, a review of the remake of Rear Window, starring Christopher Reeve. This is Fresh Air. Sunday, ABC presents a remake of Alfred Hitchcock's classic 1954 suspense film Rear Window, starring Christopher Reeve in the role originally played by James Stewart. It's Reeve's first starring role since the 1995 accident that damaged his spinal cord. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
In the 50s, Alfred Hitchcock used Jimmy Stewart's popularity and likability to help him make films about characters that might otherwise seem a little too twisted to accept as the hero. In Vertigo, Hitchcock casts Stewart as a man so obsessed with his dead wife that he remakes a lookalike into her exact image, down to the wardrobe and hairstyle. And in Rear Window, Hitchcock had Stewart play a guy with a broken leg, holed up in his apartment, and slowly but surely becoming a serious voyeur, spying on all his neighbors in the building across the street. By casting Christopher Reeve in this Rear Window remake, this TV version makes the hero physically weaker, which, as it turns out, makes much of the suspense even stronger. This new Rear Window is such a complete overhaul, at least at first, that it takes almost half an hour to establish the hero's physical disability, his confining apartment, and his across-the-street view of every day and every night life. In Hitchcock's movie, all that was established silently and quickly with one long and clever camera pan during the opening credits. But that's not to say this new version, adapted by Eric Overmyer and Larry Gross from the original Cornell Woolrich story, is wasting its time. By spending so much energy establishing Reeve's character of Jason Kemp and his everyday tribulations and medical equipment, we come to understand just how resourceful, and yet how vulnerable, Jason really is. In Hitchcock's original, Stewart's character had a broken leg but otherwise could fend for himself. In ABC's Rear Window, the hero, like Reeve, is paralyzed from the neck down, which makes his voyeurism a lot more understandable. As Reeve plays these scenes, there's not only curiosity in his eyes and voice, but a little envy and excitement as well. Here he is, being caught at the window by his personal orderly, played by Christopher Reeve. played by Ruben Santiago Hudson.
Hey, man, what you doing sitting here in the dark?
I'm spying on my neighbors. I think she's just discovered her husband's got an online girlfriend. Oh, now she's really reading him the riot act.
Serious melodrama.
I'm telling you.
I'm going to have to try to fix you up one of those personal surveillance devices, get you that all-important bird's eye view.
Would that make me a bona fide no two ways about it, Peeping Tom?
Definitely.
Go for it.
Ready for bed now?
No, I want to stay up a while, you know, like a grown-up.
Got a lady friend I can go see.
Beautiful.
So she caught him cheating on the internet, huh? You thinking about fooling around in cyberspace, man?
Well, about the only way I can fool around right now. It wasn't always that way.
You were a ladies man back in the day.
I did okay.
I bet you did. Fix you that surveillance.
Thanks.
But it's the real world, not cyberspace, that gets this guy in trouble. As in the original, he suspects one neighbor of murder, confronts him with the information, then gets confronted in turn. And when the bad guy breaks into Jason's apartment in this version, it's as scary as when Alan Arkin terrorized a blind Audrey Hepburn in Wait Until Dark. Director Jeff Blechner gets to play Hitchcock, giving lots of information visually, especially for a TV movie, and stacking up the suspense, and he does a fine job. The only weak links are Daryl Hannah, who had to work with a very watered-down version of the Grace Kelly part, and a final scene that's not as satisfying as it could have been. But it's Christopher Reeve, as both star and one of the executive producers, who carries this Rear Window. Despite the obstacles he had to overcome, he's delivered the most entertaining telemovie of the entire November sweeps.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966, the Royal Albert Hall Concert, documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.